Welcome back to HTP Podcast, where we go beyond just strokes and strategy. And our mission here today is to change the culture of tennis, having one conversation at a time through a more holistic and positive approach. And today I have Kyle here. Now, funny enough, Kyle, I actually first met you, which wasn't like the ideal introduction. I know you have either coached so many players or helped educate other coaches, but our actual first intro was like when I was getting my USPTA, I think, like, gosh, back in, I want to say, like 2012, maybe 2011.
Wow.
Yeah. So
Wow.
I was like, so you don't see too many coaches your height and your size. Time I remember you. And then through Leslie, we got introduced in a much more, better setting. For me, it was very divinely at that time because I was just sort of getting back into tennis, getting my feet wet again. I'd been out of it for a few years. I remember like talking to my friend afterwards and I was like, you know what? I really do like tennis people. It was like so refreshing to be around tennis people again, to have that shared love for a sport and just being around like-minded people who have been through the trenches at different times. I really, really enjoyed, our conversations. Ever since then, we've stayed connected and I always appreciate your support. For you to share some of your background in tennis, I know you have a long list of expertise. Go into as much as you want because we're here to listen.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And thanks for having me on the podcast. I listen to it all the time, and it's great to see your evolution in this. I know the last time you kind of met in person was actually the second to last time was when we had that dinner, and we kind
Yes.
of were like formally introduced by our mutual friend Leslie Banks. And we had a great conversation. You were telling me about this idea and this concept, and I was like, okay, but just do it. Just
Yeah,
do it.
yeah.
And it was like, you took a deep breath, and I'm like, you just got to take the first step. And I'm so glad that you listened to me. Not everyone does, but you listened to me, and I'm glad that that everything is starting to kind of blossom, and it's a beautiful thing to watch. Thank you first and foremost for having me on. It's great to be on, and thanks for going back down memory lane and talking about my USPTA tester days. Tested like 1,800 pros,
Yeah.
so it's so many, and it was probably in Boca Raton.
Yep, it was at the Oaks.
So that was my old club that I was there for 19 plus years. So I saw a lot of coaches come and go. And the tennis world is small, and we kind of reconnected, and just so happy to be here.
Awesome. Thank you. Kyle, if you can share with us where tennis really started for you to where you are now and what you do with sets.
Sure. Grew up in Florida, born and raised a native Floridian, one of like eight left, I think. But grew up in the Tampa Bay area, and I was actually a swimmer. I was a competitive swimmer from a very young age,
Okay.
and my life aquatic, grew up in the water, was fortunate enough to have a pool in my backyard, and I just pretty much spent my entire childhood in the pool. A couple of years later to get used to dry land, I was familiar with the water, and I became a pretty competitive swimmer. Being 6'6" and having size 16 feet certainly helped me. They still do now, but was into swimming, and it was pretty competitive. And most people look at swimming as a recreational activity, which is fine. They don't realize how absolutely brutal and disgusting it is as a sport. The sweating in the pool and the chlorine and the whistle blowing in the early morning practices. At the time, I was still a really young kid. I was like 9 or 10. And I was 11 at the time when USA Swimming came to me and said, hey, you have a lot of potential. We'd like to kind of have you train a little bit harder and do this and do that. And he dropped like this 8-inch binder on the desk in front of me. And this 8-inch binder, page by page, had like every day for the next 7 years of my life until I was 18, and I was going to swim in the 2000 Olympics. And they're like, if you follow this path, you'll do this. I'm still a kid. Like, I still want to play. I still like swimmer, but I was never a good swimmer because I was competitive. I was a good swimmer just because I was good at it and I enjoyed it. And then this is too much. I just want to find something fun that I can do for maybe the rest of my life. I don't see myself being a competitive swimmer for the rest of my life. I gave that up to Michael Phelps, and he He took it and ran with it, but no. So then I kind of found tennis as sort of cross training,
Okay.
and there's just something about tennis. I loved it, and it was very similar to swimming where it was individual, but it was still very physical. It was a great workout, and it was just that repetition. Like I remember being in the pool in the aquatic center, and I did backstroke. So when I would be swimming, I'd always be looking up at the sky or at the ceiling, and I remember counting the rivet in the Olympic size pool, and I'd get to rivet 84 in the ceiling, and then I would make the turn to get to 86. So it's just that constant repetition that I really enjoyed. And so tennis was kind of the same thing because I had a
Yeah.
hitting wall next to my house. So I would hit
Okay.
and I would hit and I would hit and I would try to make it to some obscene number of hits. And then I would, in my imagination, I would play out a match like finals of Wimbledon against Stefan Edberg or finals of Wimbledon against Boris Becker. I'd be out there for hours and then I would ride my bike a couple miles across town and I would sit by the park and I'd wait for a random game to show up and I'd play with anybody at any level. I didn't care. I just wanted to play.
Yeah.
And then I started getting more and more serious about it, but I would still go back to the wall every time. No matter how good I got, I would always go back to the wall and I'd always pretend that I'm playing in the Wimbledon finals. And of course, the joke is nobody's lost more Wimbledon finals than me. I've lost like 500 Wimbledon finals against Becker and Edberg and Sampras, but playing. And then I realized, wow, this is something, this is really special. And just like you mentioned earlier, I really enjoyed the people that I was meeting through tennis. More so than in swimming. In swimming, it's tough to be social because you're like huffing and puffing and you're underwater and it's just gross. And so, but tennis was just, special. And I met so many cool people through it. And I said, maybe I could make a future in this. I still wanted to go pro. I still wanted to win Wimbledon at 17. Spoiler alert, it never happened. But I knew I wanted to continue with tennis in some way. And I didn't really know what way that was until probably I was 16. I went to this college tennis exposure camp by Ed Kraft. For those
Okay.
of you that grew up in Florida, you know who Ed Kraft is. And I went to this and I was told about this program at Fair State University, a small D2 school in Michigan. And hey, you can get a career in the tennis industry. And I thought that would be amazing if I could become like a coach and I could do this. And after that, I was just absolutely hooked. And I'm like, okay, this is my path.
That's amazing. I love that. I think it's always great anytime a tennis player also does another sport. I feel like there are, it just helps their game so much more. I know for me growing up, having older brothers, like we just played all different types of sports. You know, we've talked about some of the kids today and how, you know, they're actually missing a lot of that play time and missing certain factors that builds more of that grit in them through adversity. I feel like, you know, having those different sports helps you. Not trying to go down that path too much, but if you can share about what you're currently doing, you do a lot of different things. You've done a lot, you know, the USPTA, now RSPA, and, you know, coaching, managing, and then you have your own company Sets. If you can share a little bit about what you're currently doing at Sets.
Sure, thank you. I have my hand in a lot of different pots. Still work with the RSPA as a coach developer. I'm still doing that, which I'm very pleased with, and it's definitely a joy to give back to the industry. And just like I've been doing for the last 19, 20 years, helping other coaches kind of come up and learn more and develop. I was at a club in Boca Raton. We mentioned that before, the Oaks. I was there for 19 years, 3 months, and 24 days. But who's counting? And I certainly have the scar tissues to prove it, but no, it was a great time, and I was actually employee number one. It was my first real job out of college, and that was great. But, there's certain turning points in your life where you just kind of reevaluate what's important and where you want to go, and you kind of have to think years in advance, 5 years in advance, 10 years in advance. If you start thinking trying to get through the day or the week or even the quarter, you can't really be creative or inventive. You can't really take a big risk, and so I've always kind of been forward thinking. And 2020, actually kind of 2019, is when the idea of Sets kind of started. Had some life events happen to me in 2019, and then in 2020, in April of 2020, perfect timing, I launched my company. And I say that jokingly, but also kind of serious, to where when the world was zigging, I was zagging, and when everyone was running out of the building, the burning building, I was running into to save that bundle of kittens. And I just knew that perfect time to kind of get my teeth into the industry, because there are going to be a lot of people that were having existential life crises that were just going to make them think about their future, about their career. And I'm like, hey, I don't know if anyone else is doing this, but I want to do this. I have an idea. And come to think of it, no one else is really doing what I'm doing. So I'm kind of a monopoly there. No one's really even pursued this route where I'm simply like a full-time coach developer. I talk to coaches all over the world. I bring them onto my team into sets. I essentially invest in them. I'm sort of like venture capital. I find really good coaches that I see have a lot of promise, and I invest in them. I pay for their certifications. I pay for their education, paying for, I think, 10 pros to come out to Hawaii for the RSPA conference.
Wow.
There's a lot of things that I just invest in, and I try to just find really good people, and I help them out, because people might Google me and they'll see, you know, a tennis channel feature on me, or they'll see RSPA member of the year and this and that. I'm not saying these things to brag, but I'm saying these things because people might Google me and see these things that, oh, wow, this is great. This, he just probably called up Tennis Channel, or he probably just got buddy-buddy with RSPA. And I can tell you, my overnight success took 30 years. And that's a long-ass night. That's, and, you know, for me, my success, the way I got to this point is through a lot of trial and error, a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of lost time, lost money, lost relationship to get to where I am now. I'm not a gatekeeper where I'm going to say, you know what, everyone needs to go through what I went through. If I can expedite that process, and if I can help other people scale faster, better, stronger than what it took me, why would I not try to do that? The common cliche is a rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah.
And that's true if we lived in a utopian society, but we clearly don't. There's a lot of boats in the harbor that have leaks in them, that have holes in them. When that tide rises, they're going to be left behind. And that's really hard for me to see, because I know there's a lot of really good boats out there that they just need a little bit of patchwork. They need a little bit of guidance, a little bit of navigation. And we can help the industry one by one. I can't help everybody. And for the most part, people who reach out to me, who fill out an application to join sets, I turn down like 9 out of 10. And it's hard for me to do, but I have to do that, because if I'm going to invest my time and my capital in another coach, I need to make sure that they're in it for the long term. Because for me, I'm not selling a piece of paper. I'm not selling a certification. My service to them is in perpetuity. This isn't like an 8-week program or a 10-month program. This is for the rest of their career, which means it's for the rest of my career. And for some of them who are younger than me, it's really for the rest of my life. And so because of that, I need to make that full commitment. But by making that full commitment, we can go all out. We can take big swings. We can take risks. And if something goes wrong, we have time to fix it. Whereas there's nothing creative or inventive about making Q1 earnings or getting through a summer camp. When you think long term, you can be a little bit more creative, and you can have a lot of fun, and you can actually see the trajectory and the path of people going. And some of my clients have done more in 6 months than I was able to do in 5 or 10 years because of that. I'm able to just give them all my information. I'm able to give them the roadmap, the blueprint, everything I know that I have downloaded up here. I'm able to give that to them so that their success can be that much easier, because nobody needs to struggle like I've struggled.
I mean, I think that's the beauty of mentorship, is having someone who has gone down the path that you've already gone down, and they've done all, you know, the errors and the mistakes and the failures. You don't necessarily have to go through all that. Mentorship has helped me in so many ways, and I also love passing it on to others. You are exceptional at it. That is one thing I immediately noticed about you. I also noticed how great you are with, you know, people and building those relationships, as well as not being a gatekeeper. Like, there are a ton of tennis coaches who are gatekeepers. And that was one thing that I never liked about tennis. It really, like, why? Like, why would you not want to help pass it down? Wow. Like, he's just sharing information and passing it on. And it was like, yeah, there was no gatekeeping. I was like, that was really refreshing to see in the tennis world.
Yeah. I mean, the way I look at it, you know, when I pass, and I'm not trying to get morbid, but I'm acutely aware of my expiration date. For me, when you play chess, whether you're the pawn or the king, you still get put in the same box. And so it's just one of those those things where if I can pass on something, even if it's pro bono, even if I can pass on one thing to make someone else's life a little bit better, a little bit easier, why not? Because I'm not going to take that stuff with me.
Yeah, so good. So my next question for you, Kyle, is what area of the tennis industry do you think can improve on, and where do you think it has already improved on?
It's a great question. I think that requires a whole nother podcast because we could go on and on with this. But I mean, in fairness, you can't compare tennis to pickleball, to squash, to padel, to platform, to anything else. It's so different, and every sport is different and unique. And listen, I'm not going to sit here and bash any other of the sports because, quite frankly, if it gets people up off the couch and it gets them exercising and socializing, then you know what? More power to them. And for clubs, if you're a director, you poo-poo another sport, another racket sport. If the members want it and they want to pay for it, then guess what? You should probably do it. It's another revenue stream. So from a business perspective, it's great. And from a social perspective and everything else. So I'm happy with anything. That's why it's now called the rackets industry. I'm still tennis at heart, and I always will be, but I still play my padel. I've taken up squash recently. It's all good. It's all good and it's fun and it's exciting. And again, you meet new people. But for me, I think the biggest change has been the shift in people are now starting to recognize racket sport as an actual entity in terms of business, right? Mm. Before it's just like, oh, look, you're a tennis pro. Oh, isn't that nice? Like I would go to a cocktail party or some social outing. People would ask me what I do for a living. I tell them, oh, I'm a tennis professional. I'm a racket sports professional. Oh, that's so cool. You get to play tennis all day. And it's like, I wish I got to play tennis all day. I wish that would be my dream.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I'm putting out fires most of the day and I only teach tennis. But the 20% of work I do is what 80% of people see, you know? So it's one of those things where they just think I'm out there all day and it's just not the case. So I think the standards and professionalism have gotten better. We still have a long ways to go because the business idea or the concept or the business plan of racket sports hasn't really changed all that much. And if tennis were smart, it would maybe take a cue from golf, or it would take a cue from pickleball, or it would take a cue from some of the other sports. I'm not saying we have to be like them, but it's okay to learn from somebody else.
Yes.
And I think that's a big problem, is a lot of people in the tennis community, and you would know this from growing up in Florida and being in that tennis circle, like texted about this before. It's like our version of Vietnam. Like we go through like 80s and 90s junior tennis was everything. You dedicated your entire life. And it was the sacrifice of your family. Family vacations were built around the national tournament schedule and all these other things. So what ends up happening is because tennis is such an intensive sport and you need to have the three S's to really compete in tennis and to survive, you need to struggle, you need to sacrifice, and you need to suffer.
It is
a brutal, brutal sport.
Yeah.
And the better you get, the tougher it becomes. So what ends up happening is because tennis requires so much physical, financial, and emotional capital, you have an entire generation or multiple generations of people who are pretty good tennis players, but unfortunately, because of what it took to get to that level, they have no other discernible skills. They don't really have business skills.
Yeah.
They don't really have very good social skills.
Yep.
And they're just kind of like in this limbo, the social purgatory
of
like, okay, well, I'm good enough to teach tennis, but my business skills aren't good, but I got this job because it was a director job and I wanted to be a director and had that on my title. And they didn't really develop some of those business skills to understand that this is now a full industry. This isn't just a gig. Because most of us got into tennis because it's like, hey, we played in college and we can hit a forehand. And you know what? We can give a couple lessons to some rich people and we'll make really good money. It'll be the easiest 70, 80 bucks we've ever made in our lives. And at the time when we're young, we've never had as much money as we did then. We were flush with cash because we could simply hit four balls in a row, or because we hit backhands and our clients who were CEOs and industry titans, movers and shakers, were jealous of us.
Yeah.
And so it was this whole power trip of like, oh, well, I can do this. And so now it's become, we're no longer teaching lessons. We're now actually running a multi-million-dollar business. Mm. We have a multi-million-dollar property of 5 courts, 8 courts, 10 courts, however many courts you want, but there's real estate there.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have a return on investment of each court. We have a staff, we have maintenance. So now it's become more of a business.
Yeah.
And so that's really been the biggest shift and transition in the industry that I've seen is that we've gone from being strictly on-court coaches to now being actual business people. And to be frank with you, not everyone in this industry is going to make it. it because of what I just mentioned.
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
That's just the reality of the beast is not everybody can be great. And that's really one of the biggest lessons I've learned in my business is that as much as I would love to help everybody, you know, I can teach and help everybody. I can't make everyone learn because not everybody wants to be great.
Yeah.
And not everybody wants to be great for really three reasons. And this is what I try to teach people who are into sales or are starting a business or are just trying to start something and they don't understand why, although they think their product is amazing, why not everybody won't sign up for it. Because not everybody has the capacity to be the best. Most people don't really want to be the best. People just want to be left alone. They don't want to go out. They don't want to get out of their comfort zone.
Yeah.
And that it's a really hard thing. And I don't blame anybody for that because there's three key factors that prevent people from being great. There's the statistical probability, there's the hierarchy, and there's the natural, or should we say biological predisposition, right? So the first one is the statistical probability. Mediocrity scales exponentially, excellence scales incrementally. There are many more mediocre people in the world than there are excellent people. It's just that's the fact, because if we were all amazing and excellent, we would all be mediocre too. And so, so because of that, like you look at the tennis tours, tens of thousands of tennis players out there, the millions of players out there, there's only 10. There's only 10 in the world that are top 10. There's only one that's number one. And that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And then you get into point number two, which is the sort of societal norms or hierarchy that we have, right? If we live in a social environment, which we do, and we pursue things of value, which we do, there will always be a hierarchy. And so there will always be somebody who is better at something than you. But there's also going to be people that are a little bit worse than you. So again, there's going to be great, there's going to be good, there's going to be mediocre, there's going to be poor. That's just how it is, unless, again, we live in a utopian society, and we clearly don't. And then the third one, who is, I think, the most interesting one, which is we have a biological predisposition to not want to stand out, right? If you look at, and this happens in the animal kingdom all the time. If you look at a zebra, right? Why is a zebra striped black and white vertically? It's not for camouflage. You can put a zebra in front of a brick wall, in front of a forest. A zebra is going to stand out. But a zebra with its herd is not going to stand out. It cannot be distinguished as an individual from this herd from a predator like a lion. If I was to go to the zoo or if I was to go to the Serengeti and I took a can of red spray paint and I spray painted a red line across a zebra, guess which one would be the first one picked off by a lion when it got hungry? That zebra.
Yeah.
So a zebra is camouflaged like that to stay indistinguishable from the herd where it's safe. It's the same thing with excellence and with greatness, is that people, when they speak up, when they stand up, when they do something, they're separating themselves from the herd. They can be vulnerable. They can be picked off. They can be open to criticism. You look at I don't know what the exact species name is, but you look at one of those colorful Amazonian Brazilian tree frogs that are like purple and green and yellow. It's not, hey, look at me, I'm beautiful. It's, hey, stay away from me. I'm toxic. I'm poisonous. I'm going to kill you. Avoid me. Example, this happened to me over the weekend. I was in New Mexico with my wife and we were hiking this mountain trail and there were signs for, you know, rattlesnakes, like watch out. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, it's funny, a rattlesnake, it has this rattle at the end. But I said, that rattle is not for them. It's for other people or other predators that could be approaching them. It's telling you to, hey, watch out, setting off my rattle, like leave me alone. And so essentially we humans are animals. We are the exact same way. We're maybe a little bit more advanced in a couple areas, but honestly, we're the exact same way. We don't want to be separated from the pack. We don't want to stand out because it's going to make us vulnerable and open to attack.
Yeah.
So because of that, it's very hard for people to step up, and not everybody can be great.
Yeah.
But the sooner we realize that and we find something that maybe we're good at, it's a great way to kind of start some momentum. And then you start building confidence. A lot of people start getting into stuff that they don't really know, they don't really like because they're really desperate. And that's the wrong way to go about it. People have to find something that they're good at and then just start rolling along and start building confidence that way. And sorry, that's a really long-winded answer, but I think it's really important because I hear this from so many people about their staff and about this. Well, how come someone can't step up? How come I'm the one that does because you're in the excellence category and you are incremental in your population. And so it's a really interesting thing to think about. But when you have those three reasons as to why, it's kind of powerful when you're like, okay, well, I have the statistical probability, I have the societal hierarchy, and I have a natural predisposition to do the complete opposite of what I really want to do.
Yeah.
So it's easy to fall into that category.
Yeah. I mean, just to kind of chime into what you're saying, I mean, most humans, we're in fight, flight, freeze all the time. We're in survival mode.
Yeah.
I would say 80%, maybe even for some, like 98% of the time, than actually in more of like a thriving state. And I mean, just our whole nervous system is catered to that as well. You know, always going into that fight, flight, freeze can, you know, help us at times, but, you know, for fighting a tiger back in the day.
Yeah.
But nowadays, it doesn't really help us anymore. And I think it's being able to recognize when we're in that survival state and then having someone like you to point out key attributes for that person to like pull out the greatness from them is so big. And the tennis industry needs someone like you. I mean, we need people like you more and more. I love what you do and how positive you are and how you don't gatekeep and you just share everything.
Yeah.
For me, you know, you send me like positive messages and I'm just like, thank you. Cause you know, when you are starting something new, like you may have some idea of what you're doing, but there's so many other things you don't know. And it's through trial and error. So just to have like someone on your court being like, hey, you know, you're doing great. Keep going. Is not everyone does that. And it's not like people get to see it, right? It's like all the stuff that's done behind social media. You're putting in all the work. No one sees that. So Kyle, thank you so much today. You dropped so many great gems. Yeah, I was going to ask you like at the end, what's one great advice? But I was like, you just dropped like 3-5 different great gems right there.
Take it. They're all yours now. They all belong to you. So take them.
Well, soon they're going to belong to social media. So
perfect.
Thanks again for your time today, Kyle. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Hopefully we'll have you back on, you know, another time and talk about some more stuff. For anyone who likes these tennis tales, please follow, share, and subscribe.